Good morning, ma'am. How you, sir?
All right, very good. The next matter on our virtual oral argument calendar this morning is the case of Fagry v. Fagry, file number A200062. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. Please identify yourself after you, once you begin your oral argument, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. My name is Matthew Francis, and I'm an attorney from Wheaton, Minnesota, representing the appellant, Adam Fagry. And for the court's edification, if you see me looking off to my right, it's because I have a second screen over to my right, so it allows me to view my notes and stuff. So this is a case, Your Honor, where I'm asking the court to reverse the issuance of an order for protection that had been issued against my client by the district court. The basis for that, Your Honor, is twofold. Number first off is that the court relied on impermissible hearsay in order to grant the restraining order. What had happened is there was an allegation that my client had made a threat to his current wife, allegedly to kill his ex-wife. It was not a threat that was meant to be conveyed. It was something that, if it was said, as far as we know, was said in anger. The current wife went to the called a tipster hotline to report it. The tipster hotline informed the Grant County Sheriff, and the Grant County Sheriff went over to the respondent, Ms. Fagry, and informed her of what happened. And that was one of the bases for obtaining this restraining order. So at the trial that we had on this, neither the current wife, the sheriff, or the hotline tipster was called to testify. The respondent testified based upon solely what she had heard, which at this point would be triple hearsay. And it's impermissible hearsay. As outlined in my brief, there is not an exception for this to be allowed in any way, shape, or form.
What about the argument of counsel and as well as the indication of the court that they did not that he did not consider those statements for truth of the matter asserted, but only to examine whether this information made the respondent more afraid right, and had a reasonable basis to be afraid. So the judge actually said, this is not hearsay and I'm not depending on the truth of whether these events occurred or not. It's just that this information was relayed and that the information was sufficient to give her a reasonable basis to be afraid.
Correct. And Your Honor, the reason why that is not legally sound and is legally impermissible is because in order to get an order for protection, you have to prove domestic abuse. So you have to prove that actual physical harm, bodily injury, or assault occurred. That obviously didn't occur here. You have to prove that a terroristic threat was made. Well, terroristic threat is defined as being something, it's a specific intent crime that was made directly to the person with the intent to cause terror. That didn't occur here. So the third thing, which is what the court relied upon, was that it was the infliction of fear. But again, infliction of fear, if you look at the crim jigs, and it was cited in my brief, that's also a specific intent crime. My client would have had to have done something with the specific intent to cause fear of imminent physical harm to the respondent. There's no evidence, legally admissible evidence, to show that here. By way of analogy, Your Honor, if this court were to allow this type of reasoning to go through, you would be opening the door to any applicant for a restraining order to say, well, I heard this from another person. I didn't hear it directly from the person I'm trying to get a restraining order against, but I heard it from somebody else, and therefore that made me afraid. Well, how could a person defend themselves if they say, I didn't say this, without having that person there who supposedly heard it to say whether it was true or not? Because if somebody says, well, I feel afraid, well, then I could walk in there, and no offense to any of your honors, but I could walk in there and say that one of you guys said something about me. Yes, Your Honor.
Just to clarify, if indeed the court did not accept it for the truth of the matter asserted. I'm a bit confused by your response. I'm assuming by that the court did not conclude it actually was said, because that would be the hearsay. So therefore, it would not be the basis for the fear of imminent harm. Am I incorrect in that assumption? I know the court did put it in a finding, but the court did seem to be careful in wording it that respondent had made known an intent. But the point being, if I understand the ruling correctly, that would not form the basis for the actual fear of imminent harm, but just the reaction of her, which together with other factors or other abuse that was alleged would support domestic abuse. Am I understanding that correctly?
If I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, I think so. But that too is contradictory, because you can't issue a restraining order. And let's, for the sake of this discussion at this point, just focus only on this one issue of whether or not of allowing the hearsay in regardless of the past acts of abuse. You still have an issue here where you cannot say she's reasonably in fear of imminent physical harm without there being a finding that a threat occurred. Because otherwise, like I said, you can then issue a restraining order. Someone can get a restraining order against anybody by saying, a third party told me this. Oh, I'm not going to have that third party testify. I'm just going to tell you how I felt when I heard about it. How is a respondent in a domestic abuse or an HRO supposed to defend themselves getting up there and say, I never said it? And the other person says, well, I don't care if you said it, I feel afraid.
Well, I think the major finding supporting the issuance of the OFP here was the fact of the incident involving the door slamming on her arm, or her and the bruises she had on her arm. Right. And that was the incident, along with the violations of the harassment restraining order. And I think that's the context the court used to issue the current OFP. And I guess in light of the Thompson v. Shermshire case, how did the court err in allowing that information about these prior incidences of abuse? Because obviously in the Thompson case, that there was a 3-year delay in bringing those claims of abuse, and in that case the husband had been out of the picture, out of the state for those 3 years, hadn't right. even been in the state. So how do you get around that case, I guess, in claiming that the court erred by considering this evidence?
And that's where I come into my second part of my argument about the collateral estoppel or res judicata, Your Honor. The court, a court, had already ruled on those issues in issuing a harassment restraining order against my clients. In other words, those facts were already put in front of a court for a restraining order. It might have been a different type of restraining order, but still it was a restraining order in 2017, and they were issued. So that, again, we're talking about, I mean, this case involves a whole bunch of new facts or new issues that have not been in any other appellate court decision in Minnesota. So now in this situation, you're allowing somebody to get a restraining order and then come back and get either get an HRO and then come back a couple of years later and get an OFP, or vice versa, on the same set of facts. Under an order for protection, you can certainly get a second restraining order or renew the restraining order if the court can show a reasonable fear of imminent, or reasonable fear still exists and the restraining order should be continued. Here, we're not talking about that because you already have a restraining order. It's still in place based upon, well, actually the one that's 2017 had expired, the one that she received just I think a month before this order for protection was based upon harassing text messages. And I'm not challenging those. And I'm not, obviously what my client said in those text messages is inexcusable, but those things already were adjudicated. And the petitioner, I'm sorry, Ms. Fagery even said in the first restraining order, well, I thought about filing for a order for protection, but I didn't do it because there hadn't been any physical abuse since our separation. No.
Well, but isn't the first element of applying either res judicata or collateral estoppel that you have to have the same set of facts or circumstances. And in this case, I think what the respondent was claiming is, I do have these background incidences of a domestic abuse. And I do have, I mean, I was injured, and that was domestic abuse. And there's been numerous violations of the harassment restraining order. And in addition, I still have this reasonable fear because of these other things. So it's not exactly the same set of circumstances, is it? I mean, it's basically the prior circumstances form some context for her claim that she's still in reasonable fear. And again, under Thompson, isn't this allowed? I mean, isn't this an appropriate way to present the evidence and obtain a continuing HRO or OFP?
With respect, Your Honor, no, it's not. I'm trying to search real quick for my argument here. Okay, so this issue must be, when you're looking at collateral estoppel, it's the same as a jury judicata, the issue must be identical to one in a prior adjudication. Well, in 2017, she wanted a restraining order based upon an allegation that he had abused her. Well, she's doing it same incident, so, and she got her restraining order. So now she's coming back.
But she's claiming more, though. I mean, she's claiming, I'm still in reasonable fear,
right,
because of these other things that have happened since then. So
right,
it's not the same set of circumstances, is it?
It is, because, well, with reliance upon the alleged domestic abuse, it is. When you talk about the new things, that gets back to the first part where the court relied on impermissible hearsay for her to say, well, I don't have any witnesses here to say that the guy actually said it, but because somebody told me he said it, I'm in fear. And that, again, goes back to any respondent's inability, complete inability, to say, well, you shouldn't feel that way because I never said it.
Mr. Franzese, can I ask you a question to follow that point? What do you understand in the record to be the new, I'm putting quotes around new, and in terms of allegations that gave rise to the order for protection? In other words, other than the statement that the sheriff relayed, which we understand is not a basis separately because of the court's ruling, was not accepted for the truth of the matter, what else was alleged specifically to support the order of protection, for which past incidents may then be used to infer fear of imminent harm?
That's it. That was the only thing that was new, because again, she had just gotten a harassment restraining order like a month earlier.
So you're explaining to me that the only new incident that gave rise to her order for protection less than a month, I believe, since the last harassment restraining order was the statement of the sheriff of what his current wife said to the dispatcher, who said it to the sheriff, to her, which was not received for the truth of the matter.
Correct.
Well, then let me follow up with that question with regard, and I agree with what Judge Hooten saw too from the order. It seems that the court gave great weight to that 2017 incident with regard to the arm for harassment purposes. My question is, was that hearing contested, and did the court at that hearing make a finding that it was domestic abuse, even though it was a harassment restraining order proceeding?
It was not contested.
So was there even a hearing on that harassment restraining order?
No, it was issued and my client did not contest it at that time.
So what you're explaining to me is that the court accepted it ex parte based on the allegation that he slammed the arm. And so the evidence at the current hearing went into detail, as I understand, about that incident. But your point being is that there had not previously been a finding of domestic abuse. Could not the court make a finding of domestic abuse based on that same Thompson case for the incident that was also used separately for harassment restraining order?
Right. I again would argue no, Your Honor, because the issue is identical. She alleged a domestic, whether it was a contested hearing or not, the court still made a finding on an ex parte basis that was sufficient to issue a harassment restraining order. Here we have the same thing. You're alleging a domestic abuse incident in 2017. was there final judgment on the merits? There was in 2017, there was a final judgment. Here we have a final judgment. In 2017, was a party the estopped party was a party who was in privity. Well, obviously the both parties were the same parties in 2017. And was there a full and fair opportunity to be heard? Yes, there was on the issue, and she won. You know, this is somewhat of a reverse case, I understand, because normally a res judicata or collateral estoppel is to prevent somebody from raising an issue they already lost on. Here, she's trying to raise an issue she won on, and she's trying to do it improperly, and the court is impermissibly allowing that to influence the issuance of this restraining order by using it as a saying, well, you know, yes, this is hearsay, and yes, I'm not going to rule that he said this threat, but based upon these past acts, I'm going to grant the restraining order. But, and I should also point out to the court with respect to that issue, the court also made an impermissible finding, and I cited in my brief the In Re Marie case. The court made a finding of fact that my client slammed the door on Ms. Fagery. Ms. Fagery didn't testify to that. She specifically said, in that incident, Mr. Fagery had taken my phone. We were still living together, and I was attempting to get my phone back from him. He went to the bathroom, and when I followed him to get my phone, he shut me the door, causing severe bruising along the underside of my arm. And my client followed up with the testimony saying, yes, I grabbed her phone. She was cheating on me. I went in there, and as I turned to shut the door, she had stuck her arm in. I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident. And she didn't contest that. And so the court cannot make a finding that the door was slammed when she didn't testify to that. That was part of her petition. And so, and that kind of gets back to my old, you know, my thing was this, and domestic abuse has to be a specific intent to cause physical abuse. Here, my client, both parties' testimonies were that my client was trying to get away from her, and her arm got caught in the door when he was trying to shut it in order to get away from her. It wasn't like he punched her. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, your time is up. And in fact, you had a few extra minutes there, but you will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent may proceed at this time.
Thank you. Michael Dolden representing the respondent. As you all know, she was the petitioner below in the order for protection matter. Domestic Abuse Act itself is remedial. It's designed to be interpreted liberally to advance its general purpose, which is to protect individuals from domestic violence or the threat of that violence. In doing that, trial courts have been directed to consider the unique relief that's available in the Domestic Abuse Act and the devastating consequences that not granting relief can result in. That is, as you all know as well, the court has broad discretion in issuing these orders and will only be reversed based on a significant evidence indicating error in a view of law or application of rules of evidence and so forth.
I just want to direct you to one of the arguments made by counsel for the appellant here. And that is that if you allow this, in this case, where you can't point to any specific incident, recent incident, that would indicate that she should be fearful, and you just allow just comments that are made by third parties or others, I mean, wouldn't this really open up continual HROs or OFPs, if that's all you need?
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, in this case, there is a specific previous finding of an act of assault that occurs in 2017. As a result, that gives rise, as you know, and have indicated already under Thompson, to my client's right to seek an order for protection. And it's not time sensitive at that point. I mean, as you know, with regard to even the looking at all of the surrounding circumstances, that's even not time sensitive based on the case law. And so certainly the court can address, and my client can apply for an order for protection simply based upon the fact that there was an act of violence that occurred against her and a finding that violence occurred against her. Then the trial court's required to look at the current circumstances. And I would suggest that one of those new current circumstances is in fact her feelings about what has been reported to her. And so what changes between the 2019 harassment restraining order that's issued 3 or 4 weeks before the OFP. Is the information that she receives, whether true or not, and the impact that that has on her in terms of the fearfulness she has for her personal safety based on that information that's been provided to her. It Mr. creates
Dolan, can I inquire about that, Mr. Dolan? I'm a bit confused by that argument only because it's a twofold question that I have. If the court does not accept it for the truth of the statement, how can we even find from that the statement is made such that fear from a statement the court cannot find is made has a proper basis to create fear? That's part of the question. But secondly, with regard to, it does seem like the entire basis for the order of protection, the incident, domestic abuse, is found for the first time in this hearing to have been the 2017 incident with the arm. Because we know from the record there was no hearing, it was simply found, and we know that harassment order, restraining orders has different elements, does not require domestic abuse. So Mike, it seems like the Thompson case and our other cases that we've considered, there is always a current incident for which a court can infer fear from past incidents. But the record here does not allege any current incident, and the past incident, she chose a remedy of a restraining order, and indeed, if that's the basis for the current order for protection, is that not indeed the exact same proceeding for which she previously chose to request a restraining order, but now wants to use that same proceeding for another order for protection, a different proceeding, an order for protection?
By definition, Your Honor, any time that we are using something that happened in the past, we're going to have time issues with regard to when it occurred. And secondly, the possibility that a previous order had existed. In the 2017 order, the order that's issued, among other things, indicates the trial court there making a determination that there is physical or sexual assault to the petitioner. If you look at the definition of what constitutes domestic assault under the domestic assault statute, it is physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And so there's nothing inconsistent about a finding by the court that something in 2017 would have constituted domestic assault, even though that court might not have been requested to make that finding in 2017. Those aren't inconsistent factual findings that someone would be collaterally stopped from arguing. In fact, they're consistent. And so once that finding was made in 2017 of an act of physical assault, that in and of itself constitutes domestic assault under the statute. They have the relationship required to make that act of assault, domestic abuse under the statute.
So just to clarify, Mr. Dolan, assuming, as I do by my question, only because of the record, unless you can correct me, there's no new incident. Would it be generally your understanding that any petitioner for an order for protection to allege imminent fear of harm may raise an issue that's 2 years old as the basis for the fear of imminent harm?
The case law with regard to imminent harm, Your Honor, specifically indicates that the court should consider all relevant and surrounding circumstances and does not include any indication as to what the time frame would be for those circumstances to be considered. If you look at the fact—
Can you point to any particular case where there's no new allegation? That's my question. Is I understand the totality and the circumstances and the remedial order for protection statute, but my question is, do you have a particular case where there was no new allegation that would support it, but when combined with the older 2-year-old incident?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, it would be, is there a case that I can indicate to you where somebody got an HRL, goes back and uses same or similar facts to get an OFP later?
Well, it wouldn't have to be an HRO at all. I guess what I'm just really getting at is an incident that's 2 years old is the sole basis for a current order for protection.
Well, it wasn't the sole basis for the order for protection, however, Your Honor. It is a basis to allow the court to look at the remaining circumstances that surround, which include incidents that occurred in 2019, continuing behavior by the respondent. And if you look at the court's specific findings in her order for protection order, what she indicates is she indicates the slamming door. She indicates text threatening in the past. both in 2017 and 2019, but at the end indicates petitioner's knowledge that the respondent has several loaded guns available and a permit to carry a gun, and the information from the sheriff contributed to her genuine fear that he would inflict harm on her given the text messages directly from him and his previous actions towards her. So it seems to me what the trial court was doing is supplementing that old information with new information, including the fact that the applicant was fearful at the time given new information. And I think she was also considering the fact that in that original 2017 application for the HRO, my client had indicated, I was gonna seek an OFP, but since he's quit being violent towards me, I decided I want an HRO. And so that progression that happened in 2017 makes what happened in 2019 more logical, that she got an HRO, then discovered in her mind at least that she had a basis to be more fearful and went back to ask to the court for more. As to whether this opens it up to an opportunity to argue multiple times that you should get an HRO based on a past circumstance, I do not think it does, because I still have to present information about a totality of circumstances, which includes enough for a judge today to say, I understand why you're here today, as opposed to waiting 2, 5, 7, or 10 years to be here today. And in this case, that's basically what the judge did. She said, I understand that the statement made by girlfriend or wife and sheriff would up the ante for you in your mind, petitioner, and therefore I understand why you're here. And when I look at all of these other circumstances, it certainly seems to indicate to me that number one, we had an act of domestic violence, and number two, that you have a legitimate reason to be imminently fearful based on the nature of the threats he has made in the past and presently.
Mr. Dolan, this is Judge Flory. Let's assume that this threat was never conveyed to her. Would she have been able to come back to the court seeking an OFP based solely on the allegations that were found to be true in the two prior HROs, one of which was obtained a month before the OFP? Do we even need this threat to allow her to seek the relief she's sought here? What's your position on that?
My answer to that would be no, Your Honor. They didn't need the new threat. There's nothing inherently inconsistent about having both an HRO and an OFP. The only way that res judicata would have affected that is if there had been a specific finding that there was not an assault in 2017 or 19, and now the petitioner, the respondent here, comes back to court and says, I'd like you to find that there was on these past facts. That would be precluded by collateral estoppel or res judicata. But here, I find no case or statutory authority to indicate you couldn't have both an HRO and an order for protection based on the same facts. There are a number of cases where somebody applies for an OFP and the judge says, I don't think you have OFP material here, I'm giving you an HRO. In that circumstance, if she applied again, I think res judicata would apply. But here, that isn't what happened. Actually, what she's asking for is something more specific than what the HRO court would have granted in the first place, requiring an additional element, domestic relationship, and a more specific element with regard to fear or threats for physical harm. So I think in answer to your question, Judge, I think the answer is, even without the information from the sheriff and the new wife, could an individual seek an OFP on facts that granted an HRO? I think the answer is yes. So in a larger sense, I think that the court tried to do what the court is directed to do here, take a look at the entire circumstances, look at a history of parties from 2017 and the actual threats to do physical harm back in 17, similar threats, although different in nature in 2019, and basically conclude that there's a reason to issue an order for protection. I do not think, as I've noted, that that would have been precluded by the fact that an HRO concurrently was issued. No different than in a criminal case finding that someone committed assault because they caused fear of bodily harm and because they actually caused bodily harm. Two counts, same facts. There's nothing that would preclude that. obviously two trials and double jeopardy would in that circumstance if someone came back later. But here in this civil proceeding, there would be no limitation on her ability to seek that. And there's a reason to. You get different relief, the potential to address custody and parenting time issues, and maybe more specifically in this case, a right to have that order listed so that it can be seen by any law enforcement individual, which HRO cannot be. The ability to enforce it with contempt, which technically HROs cannot be enforced with. And also the possibility of it impacting on the possession of firearms, which the petitioner obviously indicated she was concerned about in her application. So unless anyone has any other questions, I have no further comments. If we were in Congress, I would yield my time.
Okay. Anyone have any questions? All right. The appellant may have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Mr. Dolan just acknowledged that if his client had tried to get it, or somebody tries to get an order for protection, they get denied, that they're then precluded from getting an HRO. That's just kind of the same thing here, just a reverse situation. You went and get an HRO, now you're trying to get an OFP in large part based upon the same set of facts. And further, as Mr. Dolan acknowledged, that when you have two types of assault, you have intentional infliction of fear and intentional bodily harm. If you don't try them both together or prosecute them both together, and you just said try to prosecute one in one at one time and then try to come back and do the second one at a second time, you're prohibited, regardless of what happened to the first trial, whether it was a conviction or not, you're still precluded from coming back a second time to get a second bite at the apple. While those are criminal cases.
Can I just ask you?
Your Honor, you froze up on me. Oops.
Yeah, I think she was frozen up on everyone here. Why don't we stop the clock for a moment and wait for Judge Hooten to rejoin us.
Technology.
Judge Hooten, can you hear us? Sounds like she's temporarily lost her connection. So let's just see what happens here in a second. Okay. Yeah, it seems like she's still disconnected. Judge Hooten, while you were disconnected, what I asked is that we stop the clock on the
and I think that's argument fair. Here.
And so when you're ready, we can proceed again.
All right. And I don't know why we're having these issues today, because this is all new to me. I haven't had any issues. But anyway, you may proceed once again and we'll start the clock over. So
Your Honor was asking me a question, if the court recalls a question.
Yes, and I was asking about Thompson, and the reason I'm asking about Thompson is in that case there was no new incident. In fact, there had been minimal contact between the parties, only through a TV where the husband, who is a psychiatrist living in California, communicated with the son, and the respondent in that case had no indication or could not cite to anything that had occurred in the 3 years she had been living in Minnesota. He had never been to Minnesota. There had been nothing that she could point to, but the Supreme Court held in that case that the only issue was whether she was in reasonable fear for her safety. Right. And even though she had nothing except her very emotional plea for the OFP, the court granted it. I mean, how in this case, how with evidence regarding his access to guns, his ownership of guns, as well as these statements she's heard, I mean, how can you distinguish this case from Thompson, where there was really a lot, I think a lot less evidence supporting a current imminent fear than there was in Thompson?
My opinion, very easily, Your Honor. Personally, quick side note, there's no record of my client ever threatening Ms. Fager with firearms. Using firearms, even implicitly doing that, it's just a matter that she has them. You know, just because if I'm a martial art instructor, you're going to be, I mean, that you're just implying a fear because of what someone's abilities or what they have without, there needs to be a causal connection to that. But getting specifically to Thompson, I had a chance to kind of look at it while Your Honor was out. And when you look on page, what page is that? 497, where they recount the history, there's still a ton of interaction that took place between the parties. They were trying to go back into court fighting for custody and visitation rights. There was, she'd filed restraining order, I think at least once, and got it. It was dismissed because she didn't show up. So, but I think the main distinction is there was not a prior restraining order issue. And here, and that's the big distinction here, and that's my basis for my argument. There already was a restraining order based upon the allegations that there was a domestic assault. And yes, it was a harassment, not an order for protection, but there's still, you know, as far as a petitioner is concerned, whether you get an HRO or an OFP, there's no distinction. You still have the same protections against no contact. You have the same criminal protections that if you violate it, it's an escalating violation each time it happens. You're still prohibited from firearms. There is no, as far as that person is concerned, there isn't, the protection is still there. And I will submit to the court, if this 2017 HRO had not been, it was not there, or if she had not alleged the domestic assault in 2017, I would not have brought this case. We wouldn't be here. It's only because of that 2000 petition had the interceding finding that there was a domestic abuse incident that we're arguing. You can't come back again and argue that. And again, if she, and by the same point, if the inadmissible hearsay of this alleged threat against her didn't take place, Ms. Vagary would not have been seeking an order for protection. The only reason why she did is because now she thinks he's trying to kill her, and whether she realizes it's not really any additional protections for her or not, she, you know, I'm not, we'll get into that, but you can't now come back and say, well, I want a restraining order. I've already got a restraining order based upon these facts. And now here's this additional fact, which, by the way, I'm not going to present any evidence.
So Mr. Franzi, this is Judge Florian. I know your time is up, but I have this question I've been wanting to ask. Well, sure. On your hearsay argument, would your argument be different had a respondent called your client's present wife to say, I heard this statement made? Or would you be making the same argument here today?
I mean, in so far as it's inadmissible hearsay based upon spousal privilege under 595.02,
well, I'd be making the same argument. I see what you mean. Yeah, there would be a spousal privilege issue. I agree. Correct. But it seems to me your argument is strongest on the claim that we didn't even hear testimony from anyone that says they heard this, as correct, opposed to whether it was for the truth of the matter asserted.
But by arguing inadmissible hearsay, I'm arguing that there was no evidence presented that he actually said it. Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I guess my time is up.
All right. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and we will issue a decision within the statutory period of time. Thank you.